For nearly 17 years since the FDA black box warning about suicidality with antidepressants, our community has been quoting data that downplays this concern. We were wrong. We were deceived. Antidepressants can be life-saving, but there really is a duty to warn. In this episode, Drs. Martha Ignaczewski and Glenn Spielmans talk with us about what went on and how to talk about it with our families. Welcome to the CARLAT Psychiatry Podcast. This is a special episode from the Child Psychiatry team. I'm Dr. Josh Fader, the editor-in-chief of the CARLAT Child Psychiatry Report and co-author of the Child Medication Factbook for Psychiatric Practice.
And I'm Mara Governman, a licensed clinical social worker in Southern California with a private practice, and I'm also a regional director at Positive Development Institute.
So let's get right into it. The sound we're using from this episode is an interview I did with Drs. Martha Ignaczewski, a fellow at the University of California, San Francisco, and Dr. Glenn Spielmans, a professor of psychology at Metropolitan State University in St. Paul, Minnesota. Glenn started by giving us the background.
Let's start with where it began. So, of course, the 2004 black box warning was based on a higher rate of treatment emergent suicidality on antidepressants than placebo. And pretty shortly after that, some researchers claimed that this black box warning ended up resulting in fewer kids taking antidepressants, and then that led to more suicides, was sort of the line of logic. So, and I think among a lot of people that those arguments really gathered some currency and have really become accepted wisdom. But the research evidence actually really supports the black box warning pretty well.
This black box warning was and still is a big deal for those of us working in child and adolescent mental health. What are your thoughts on it, Mara?
I recently attended an online suicide conference, and here's some really interesting things that I learned. According to the World Health Organization, every 40 seconds, a life is lost to suicide. 156% more people killed themselves than were murdered by others. In 2018, the American Association of Suicidology said the number two cause of death in the 16 to 24 age group was suicide, and that number was 6,211. In the 25 to 34 age group, the second cause of death was suicide, and that was 8,020. Another really interesting statistic is that in 2015, in typical high school students, one male and two females have probably attempted suicide. So I'd say, yeah, this is a really big problem and a big concern, especially in the time of pandemic, that we have to discuss and address with our clients.
We're having it in our practices. Mara and I were just talking a few minutes ago before we started recording this episode about a family we're working with where somebody, you know, had an overdose. And it's in the context of certainly all the difficulties families have. But on top of it, as you say, the pandemic is making it even worse. There are aspects of this we definitely need to understand better. First of all, is there really a correlation between antidepressant use and suicidality in
kids? Dr. Spielman's team dug into the studies, and there's some important nuance to our understanding of this issue.
Exactly. Here's what he had to say about the data surrounding the black box warning.
Anyway, antidepressant prescriptions for kids have been increasing, and also suicides among kids have been increasing. Now, I don't really think that you can make much of a conclusion based on that. I think, and what this is something we got into in our paper, is that, you know, you can look at the population suicide rate, and you can look at the population rate of prescriptions, and you can look at how those things relate to each other. But I think it's pretty unwise to draw conclusions based on that. There's all sorts of variables that influence suicide, as, you know, all clinicians know. So, you know, you've got kind of what's going on with the economy in terms of unemployment. You've got drug use by the kids. You've got drug use by their parents. You've got parental military deployments, which can influence suicide rates, et cetera. You got all of those sort of things and many others going on at any given point in time. So the best way to examine, do antidepressants, you know, cause suicide in some cases, is to look at controlled trials, which is the foundation for the black box warning in the first place. So I think a lot of the studies that came out and looked at these population-wide studies or population-wide data, I think can be pretty misleading. First of all, the decrease in antidepressant prescriptions for kids in the USA was relatively modest. And kind of depending on the source and the time frame that you look at, it was either a modest drop in prescribing or more just really slowing down the rapidly upward trajectory in antidepressant prescriptions that was occurring beforehand. So in the late 1990s to early 2000s, there was a really big increase in the number of antidepressants that were prescribed. And this, you know, this leveled off and decreased to an extent, but it didn't plummet. In the United Kingdom, the prescribing rate plummeted. And there was no increase in suicides there, by the way.
Why would the UK show different trends?
Dr. Spielmans attributes that to potentially cherry-picked data on U.S. suicidality.
Another thing we looked at was that sometimes you can just cherry-pick certain years. So a very influential paper in 2007 by Robert Gibbons and his team looked at a one-year relationship. There was a one-year time period, there was a decrease in antidepressant prescriptions and an increase in suicides. It was a time series of 1 year, which is ridiculous to draw conclusions from. You know, every year there will be blips in the data with more or less suicides, more or fewer antidepressant prescriptions. So that paper has been cited hundreds of times. It's a meaningless paper.
And that wasn't the only problem they found with Gibbons' research.
Another paper from the Robert Gibbons team claimed that the Prozac studies showed that there was not an increase in suicide risk, but what they used to measure suicide risk was, if you're familiar with the Children's Depression Rating Scale that's used to measure treatment effects, they picked the one item that measures suicidality of that measure, and they said that based on that, there's no increase in suicide risk. The problem is the FDA says that's not a good measure of suicide risk. And GlaxoSmithKline's own analysis also found that it's not a good measure of suicide risk because most prescribers are aware that paroxetine Paxil showed a pretty substantial increase in suicide-related adverse events relative to placebo. If you use the Child Depression Rating Scale to assess suicide risk, you don't see that. So you see more actual events, but that rating scale doesn't detect it.
When you put all this data together, it becomes clear that the relationship between antidepressants and suicidality is much more complex than the black box warning indicated. Those time series observational studies don't tell the full picture. Simply looking at antidepressant prescriptions and comparing that to suicide rates doesn't help us understand what's going on and doesn't help us understand how to talk to our patients about this potential.
Dr. Ignaszewski's research found no increased suicidality with antidepressant treatment. Here's what she had to say about those findings.
When I set out to write my paper, I wasn't thinking specifically about suicidality associated with antidepressants. I was thinking about more of an update about what new antidepressants had been studied since seminal meta-analyses come out, and thinking about what the evidence was about the effectiveness of some of these newer medications. And that was really the direction we were going in. That's what the majority of the paper focuses on. Something that we noticed as we were going through the papers was that the way that we actually assessed treatment emergent suicidality and were thinking about that had shifted from previous papers and to more recently. And so the Columbia Suicide Rating Scale was much more frequently used and was assessing sort of what baseline symptoms of suicide looked like and actually tracking treatment emergent suicide and actually breaking it up in that way. Because one of the criticisms of previous research was that what was called treatment emergent suicidality may not be accurately representing what was going on. And because we didn't have an understanding of what the baseline suicide was like in that studied population.
So we have to wonder, how is it that Dr. Spielman's team found an association and Dr. Ignaszewski didn't? She has thoughts on that too.
With the use of the CSSRS and the articles that we found, and I did not do the same dive into looking at the raw numbers, making sure that risk and rates were accurately attributed to medication versus placebo. From the articles that we found, none of the medications versus placebo actually reached statistical significance in the use of that rating scale, which was where we came to the conclusion that based on these handful of studies that we looked at, that same signal using the Columbia rating scale was not evident. I think that the pieces that I sort of took home the most were really about how much more we as providers need to do when we're reading articles and thinking about what the data is and what has sort of become established as common and accepted practice. I wasn't aware of some of the details about the Gibbons article and the timeframes for the selection period that certainly would shift the way that we would think about this and how it's actually become sort of commonly accepted as fact when it might not be based in solid scientific evidence.
So here we are. I feel like we have a more educated understanding of the research on this than we did a decade ago. And at the end of the day, there's only one thing that matters. How does this affect the way we treat our patients?
Exactly. Here is what Dr. Ignaszewski advised on that.
In talking with my patients and their families, our understanding has been that the suicidality seems actually to have emerged in the context of worsening depressive symptoms. So not the suicidal ideation occurring in isolation, but actually traveling with other symptoms that we think about with depression. So worsening functioning, sad mood or irritability, progressive anhedonia, not wanting to spend time with friends or other enjoyed activities. And so in those situations, the way that we've approached that is to provide more frequent check-ins, to really work on safety planning. So thinking about with the kid, with the family and other trusted adults or providers, how to manage those thoughts and those feelings rather than reflexively just reducing or discontinuing the medication.
And Dr. Spielman's had this advice on talking to patients.
Letting patients and their parents know that, you know, should suicidality emerge, that this could be drug-induced, which I think gives a different spin on how we interpret, you know, the emergence of such behavior. If suicidality is automatically attributed to their depression is getting worse, you see people, you know, increasing doses, acting on perhaps some additional treatments. And if it's viewed as, well, this is possibly drug-induced, then it's probably going to be dealt with much differently. There might be dose reduction, there might be a different treatment augmentation. In either case, I would assume you're going to meet with your client more frequently, have more frequent check-ins. But I think putting the idea in people's head that, hey, this might be treatment induced, that's going to lead to some thoughtful consideration on the part of providers as to what they should be doing, as opposed to automatically thinking it's worsening depression, which could lead to dosage increase, which if it is treatment induced is certainly not something you're going to want to do.
This goes back to a thorough, informed consent process. If listeners haven't heard our episode on that, what are you waiting for? It's linked in this episode description.
Yes, we have a specific process in place with informed consent to talk about the advantages and risks of medication. This is an extremely important risk that needs to be discussed and evaluated on an ongoing basis. It's also something that clinicians need to put in the context of the patient's diagnosis, environment, and background.
They had an interesting discussion about the differentiation between SSRIs for anxiety and depression. Take a listen.
I think for anxiety, you know, you can make a pretty good case that SSRIs can be pretty beneficial. And with depression, it gets trickier in the sense of, you know, the treatment benefits, and at least according to clinical trials, not being, you know, it's more than nothing. It's more than a placebo, but usually by a pretty small amount.
Anytime I'm making a diagnosis, I really want to be cautious about over-pathologizing normal sadness, range of emotions and feelings in kids and adolescents, and actually any patient, adults or otherwise, that I'm treating. part of what makes it difficult to really suss out just how effective our medications are is that there's this really limited clarity about how much fidelity we have in terms of who we're actually enrolling in our research. And I definitely agree that that has resulted in high placebo response rates and very limited separation from active treatment. So that adds a layer of complexity. When I am talking to patients and families and thinking about making the diagnosis, I'm really focused on what the functional impairment is. And so these are usually I'm thinking about adolescents who have had a major departure from what their life and activities and trajectory has been. And they are no longer going to school. They aren't engaging in the same activities that they have. And, you know, wanting to provide some supportive work, therapeutic work, and the medication can be indicated in those situations to kind of get things back on track.
First of all, I appreciate Martha's comment about, you know, really taking a close look at impairment levels. I think that can be a good gauge as to who needs treatment and where should we kind of set the bar. As far as untreated depression goes, I think it's interesting. Over the years, I've, you know, sometimes I'll see citations to the risk of untreated depression, and I don't check the references on everything, but sometimes I'll look them up. And oftentimes it seems like untreated depression, it's hard to, frankly, do research on that. Right? You would have to find a group of people who has depression, who aren't willing to seek treatment, but are willing to participate in your study. Even for adults, the untreated depression literature is more sparse than you think, especially following people up over time. It doesn't happen very often. I think it's a little dicey to say with any certainty the risk of suicides among untreated depressed cases is such and such. I think I'm not sure we have good enough research that I would be really comfortable giving a firm number on a statistic like that.
I found this entire interview to be extremely helpful. Unfortunately, there's no definitive answer on when or how to prescribe antidepressants, but there is a clear call for awareness about the potential suicidality and also a clear call to read the research carefully and critically when we're making clinical decisions.
The detailed analysis of these studies shows me that there's a lot left to find out about this issue, and we need to consider that as clinicians, every time we work with our patients, we might want to leave that 5 or 10 minute extra time when we are interviewing our clients to ask those uncomfortable questions, including non-suicidal self-injury, such as cutting.
We have to put our patients' interests first. There's a specific part of the discussion where Dr. Spielmans runs through some of the startling instances of incorrect or manipulated data. Take a listen.
You know, my line of research is basically a dissector of studies. There was one of the trials escitalopram trial where they took a couple of the suicidal events that happened and they attributed them to placebo. But it turns out that both of these cases, and you had to read the article quite carefully to see this, both of these suicidal events happened after the people had stopped taking placebo and had started taking escitalopram in the community. So you can't logically say that placebo caused something to happen when someone stopped taking the placebo weeks ago and started taking the same drug to which placebo was being compared. The problem, I think, comes in, and Martha's touched on this a couple times, where I think a lot of times we look at research and we just kind of take it at face value without looking too closely. And the problem is too closely actually takes quite a bit of time. It takes me quite a bit of time, and I've done this for, you know, quite some time, gone through and looked at clinical trials and tried to see what kind of data reporting problems might be going on, what seems to be missing. It takes a long time. So as it's hard to, I think, casually read an article and pick up on those things. And I've also read a lot of internal drug company documents that have come out through various lawsuits over the years. It's worth considering that clinical trials, if you read what drug companies themselves say to each other about these, clinical trials are marketing exercises. So yes, they want to see how well the drug works, but when a clinical trial is written up, that is written up with marketing in mind first, science in mind second. And it's extremely clear in their own documents that this is how they view clinical trial reports. It's pretty clear if we're, you know, if we just even limit it to discussing antidepressants in kids, it wasn't until lawsuits were filed, internal documents were released, that they discovered, oh, wait, there were actually suicide-related events that happened that were not reported in journal articles. It's difficult. You know, on one hand, we're told practice evidence-based medicine, But if the evidence itself is, you know, not necessarily fully accurate, that's a problem. I was looking at a company called Phase 5 Communications, and that probably doesn't mean much to most people, but they're a firm that helps drug companies write up clinical trials and put them into a journal article. When clinical trials are done, I think it's important for people to realize that there's an industry set up around that. So there are third parties such as Phase 5 and others that will work with drug companies to, well, let me give you some of Phase 5's exact wording. Their website says, quote, "We sift through the client's raw data and polish it into the diamonds that make for great brands. Their team of powerhouse conceptual alchemists transforms scientific base metal into strategic pure gold via exceptional marketing initiatives, medical meetings, and manuscripts. Connected with the industry's top opinion leaders and marketers, Phase 5's experienced PhDs and MDs understand how to energize your data with precious meaning. The result? Powerful marketing programs to drive your brand to unexpected heights."
I mean, they're literally doctoring, quote unquote, doctoring their data to market it to doctors, right?
Right. Yes, that's exactly what they're doing. When you see the authors on these trials, you know, those are nearly always people that are associated with academic medical centers. Their role in writing the manuscript is very often little to nothing. Very often these firms write the first draft, and it's later on that the, quote, authors, the ones whose names appear in the authorship line, actually have anything to do with the paper. Related to that, I heard the term raw data was mentioned. Another thing that's kind of discomforting is that the raw data are usually not seen by the study authors, as in the people whose names are on the manuscript. Typically, the drug company or the companies they associate with to help them analyze the data, they take the raw data, they do the analysis. So by the time it gets to the, quote, authors, it's already been processed by the drug firm. In that sense, nobody really gets to see the raw data except for the company that owns it. It's their data legally, and they essentially get to do with it what they want. For instance, Study 329, for the small group of people who looks at, you know, badly done clinical trials, Study 329 of paroxetine kind of stands out. And when the lead author was deposed, there ended up being some legal action around it. The lead author was asked if he ever saw the raw data, and he said no. He said, "I'm not a numbers guy," and he said he didn't see the raw data. He just looked at the tables that were given to him by GlaxoSmithKline, which is a pretty common experience, actually, and a little disconcerting.
You know, we did this article for the Carlatt Child Psychiatry Report to make sure that people knew about the duty to warn, but the dirty underbelly of how data is managed by some pharmaceutical companies in which they hide suicide and suicidal ideation is of such importance that every mental health professional, every citizen needs to know why we have things like all trials, why we have some checks and balances getting into place, and to be careful about how drug companies can misrepresent data to their author physicians in a way that obfuscates some very important and potentially life-changing or life-ending side effects.
And so often these discussions come down to a call for better, more independent research.
And until we get better data, it's on us to keep these questions in mind and communicate this issue clearly with patients and families so we can be effective partners in preventing any self-harm while treating their depression. The printed version of this interview is available for subscribers to read in the Carlatt Child Psychiatry Report. Hopefully people check it out. Subscribers get print issues in the mail and email notifications when new issues are available on the website. Subscriptions also come with full access to all the articles on the website and CME credits.
And rest assured, everything from Carlatt Publishing is independently researched and produced. There's no funding from the pharmaceutical industry.
Yes, the newsletters and books that we produce depend entirely on reader support. There are no ads, and our authors don't receive industry funding. That helps us bring you unbiased information you can trust.
Go to www.thecarlattreport.com to sign up. You can get a full subscription for $30 off using the coupon code LISTENER.